Okay, see on your sheet is the overture, Isaiah chapter 40. I'm following through with McCrae's suggestion here of comparing this material with a musical composition. Chapter 40 is a unit in its own right, somewhat distinct from what follows. And McCrae has suggested that it compares to the overture of a musical composition in the sense that it touches on a number of the themes that reoccur in subsequent chapters, sort of introduces these themes. And then in subsequent chapters, they're further developed. But in chapter 40, everything seems to be quite general. It's not nearly as explicit or specific as much of the material that follows. It's quite general. God says he's going to deliver. But the chapter doesn't seem to have exclusive reference to one specific deliverance. It's more general. There are people who are suffering, people who are in misery. And the idea is they will be delivered from their suffering. Now that would apply to people in exile, and very well could apply to people in exile. But it also could apply to people who are suffering from the results of sin. God is going to deliver them. In other words, he will deal with the sin problem, provide a means of deliverance from it. And of course, ultimately, that comes through the coming of Christ. So that there is a certain joy involved in the chapter. And that's joy over the coming of Christ, as well as joy concerning deliverance from exile. All of that seems to be in view in chapter 40. So it's not surprising that chapter 40 is one of the great chapters of the Bible. Certainly a chapter that is often read by many people, particularly people who may be in misery or in suffering. People who are wondering what God is doing can find great comfort in this chapter. Let's look at the first two verses. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye tenderly to Jerusalem and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Comfort is to come to Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been suffering, but now she's to be comforted. She is told her warfare is accomplished. That is her hard service, her compulsory labor. Her service of war, that has been accomplished. The last phrase, she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. That's usually understood as punishment. She's received double for all her sins. But look at your citations. McCrae has an interesting suggestion there. Page 29. Taken from pages 40 to 43 of his Gospel of Isaiah, which I might mention is on this section of Isaiah, a very useful little book. A rather unusual interpretation has been the assumption that double here means double blessing, and that the phrase is a promise that Israel would receive double blessing in spite of all her sin. Such an, that should be an, interpretation lacks philological justification. There's no basis for introducing the idea of blessing into worth double. The solution to the difficulty lies in the recognition that the Hebrew word used here, one of several that are commonly translated double, can properly be considered as similar to the English word double when used to represent a person who looks so much like another that it's difficult to distinguish them. Saddam Hussein said to have a number of doubles, I understand. People look so much like him, you think you can't never know where he is because he's double. Each of them is the double of the other, but neither is to be considered as equal to twice the other. It might be clear to render it equivalent, counterpart, or substitute. The phrase looks forward to the time when God will declare that the equivalent for the sin of all believers has been paid. No man could pay this penalty. Only the divine servant of the Lord could do it. So you see, McCray understands the statement there, she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all our sins, the idea that she has received from the Lord's hand an equivalent, a counterpart, a substitute for all her sins, and pointing forward to Christ. But in any case, God says his people are to be comforted. That may be viewed as having some connection with deliverance from the exile in Babylon, but I think more basically and importantly, it has reference to deliverance from sin through Christ. You notice, I think McCray's suggestion is certainly worthy of consideration, particularly because of that phrase in the middle of the verse, her warfare is accomplished, her iniquity is pardoned. Her iniquity is pardoned. Well, equivalent substitute. A person equivalent to Israel has been substituted for her and atoned for her sin. The idea is he is suggesting. In other words, if you simply limit this to return from exile, return from exile hardly means that her iniquity is pardoned. Seems to be more involved here. Verses 3 to 5. The idea of deliverance further stressed. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill be made low, the crooked shall be made straight, the rough places plain, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. Again, the idea of deliverance. God's deliverance is at hand. A way is to be made straight. That could apply to the exile. In other words, the people in Babylon see the hills and valleys of difficulties of all sorts that separate them from their homeland being removed, enable them to go back. But the interesting thing is, in all four of the Gospels, this section is taken as a reference to John the Baptist. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord. Look at Luke 3, 4 to 6. As it is written in the book of the words of Isaiah the prophet, saying, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his path straight, every valley shall be filled, every mountain hill shall be brought low. Crooked be made straight, the rough places smooth, all flesh shall see salvation of God. And you see in the context, that's speaking of the ministry of John the Baptist. Verse 3 says, he came into all the country about the Jordan, preaching the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins, as it is written in the book of the words of Isaiah. Matthew 3:3. One says, in those days came John the Baptist, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, for this is he that was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah. This is he that was spoken of by Isaiah, saying, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, so forth. Mark 1, 2, and 3. The voice of one crying in the wilderness. Prepare you the way of the Lord, make his path straight. John did baptize in the wilderness, preach the baptism of repentance. then John 1:19-23. This is the witness of John, down to verse 23. He said, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord, as said the prophet Isaiah. So when you get to verse 5, and it says, the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, that's certainly the climax. And what can you think of but the incarnation? Glory of the Lord shall be revealed. John 1:14. We beheld his glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And John announced the way of the coming of Christ. Now, when you get to 6 to 8, to move on, complete change in idea. The voice said, cry. He said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass. All its beauty like the flower of the field, the grass withers, the flower fadeth, because the breath of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people are grass, the grass withers, the flower fadeth. But the word of our God shall stand forever. Basic idea is the failure of everything human and earthly to endure. And in contrast to that, God's word stands forever. Now, you know, that's very general. It can be applied to many situations. Perhaps to people in exile, you could be thinking of the greatness of Babylonian power. And what Isaiah is saying is human power is transient, it's illusory. All flesh is grass, it withers and fades. But the word of the Lord stands forever. Verse 9 reverts to the idea of comfort to Jerusalem, because God will bring deliverance. I think without getting into the details of this, I think the NIV is a better translation there. You notice the King James says, O Zion that brings good tidings, get thee up unto the high mount. Whereas if you look at the NIV, verse 9, you who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You bring good tidings to Jerusalem. Lift up your voice and shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. Comfort to Jerusalem because God is bringing deliverance. Verses 10 and 11. The gentleness of his deliverance. See, the sovereign Lord comes, I'm reading for the NIV, with power. His arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms. He carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. The Lord is strong to accomplish what he desires. King James says the Lord will come with strong hand. His arm shall rule for him. So he's strong. He's able to accomplish what he sets out to do. But towards his own people, he's like a shepherd who gathers the lambs in his arms, carries them in his bosom. He gently leads those that are with young. So the gentleness of his deliverance. And then with verse 12, you again get a sharp transition. I want to give you a handout here. And put an overhead up. Verse 12 and 13. For the rest of the chapter. Verse 12 says, who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and measured out heaven with a span, measured the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? get a sharp transition of thought, but see, between 11 and 12. 11 talks about the shepherd carrying the lambs in his arms, gently leading those with young. And here you come in with a completely different idea. The gentleness of the Lord stressed in 11, but that's not a sign of weakness. Verse 12 and following compare the Lord with the gods of the heathen and point out how great his power is, particularly his creative power. And certainly that idea of the omnipotent power of God is one particularly important to people who are suffering. It would be important to people in exile. It would be important to people in Isaiah's own day, in the time of Manasseh. It's important to people in any time of difficulty and suffering. There's a tendency when you're in that kind of a situation to think God doesn't exist. He's powerless. And there are a number of passages in the material that follows, chapter 40, that stress the greatness and the power of God. Now, if you look closely at the structure of verses 12 through 31, I think which I'd like to kind of lead you through a quick look at that. I think you can see that chapter is very carefully constructed. Even though that structure may be obscured by shifting from one idea to another idea to another idea and back to a first idea, a lot of movement like that, the chapter is not haphazard. It requires a fair amount of study and work to discover the structure and the relationship of the parts to each other. But remember the analogy with the musical composition. You can listen to music and be moved by the force of the music without really understanding anything about how carefully the writer structured things in order to give that force, to give that impression. So that without consciously realizing how carefully this has been structured, you can read through it and be impacted by it. But when you sit down and analyze it, you find that there's very careful structure behind it. Now, if you look at that handout, you notice that in verse 12, you have the question, who created the universe? And there are five aspects to the question, and all have the answer God. You see, who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and measured out the heaven with a span, and measured the depth of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scale, and the hills in a balance? You get five phrases there. Who has done all these things? Who created the universe? All have the answer God. That's the first strophe. The second one, both of which have to do with nature. And the second one is verses 13 and 14. There the question is, who was God's helper at creation? And again, you get five aspects to the question. You see, there's a structure there, five and five. But here, all have the answer, no one. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him? And taught him in the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding. Again, breaks down into five phrases. All with the answer, no one. And then you move to the third strophe, which is the first climax, verses 15 to 17. The nations are as nothing. You make a transition. The first two strophes deal with nature. Who created the universe? Who was God's helper in creation? The third strophe moves to history. So that in verses 15 to 17 you read, "Behold, the nations are like a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of a balance. Behold, he taketh up the coast as a very little thing. Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing. They are counted to him less than nothing and vanity." So the nations are as nothing. Babylon may look powerful, particularly if you're in exile in Babylon, but before the power of God, nations are as nothing. They're like, they are as nothing. They're like a drop in a bucket. They're counted as a small dust of the balance. See those kinds of images which point out the insignificance of the power of nations. You go on to the fourth strophe, verses 18 to 20. Radical change of idea again. You move to this theme of idolatry, the futility of idolatry. Idols don't move, 18 to 20. "To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare him? The workman melteth and casteth an image. The goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold, cast a silver change. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that shall not be moved." You notice that phrase is introduced by this question, "To whom will you compare?" To whom will you compare God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? You going to compare God with these pieces of wood created by man? So the thought of the first section is developed by comparison. God is the Lord of nature. He's the Lord of history. And you compare that with a stick of wood. To whom will you liken God? When you get to the fifth strophe, verses 21 to 24, you have a second climax. God is the Lord of nature and history. Nature and history are brought together. 21 to 24 read, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are like grasshoppers. Who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain, and spreadeth them out like a tent to dwell in. Who bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. And he shall blow upon them, and they shall wither. The whirlwind shall take them away like stubble." Now, in this second climax, you have it again introduced with a question here. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? God is the Lord of nature and history. And in the literary construction, you have four have-nots. Verse 21, introduced with this hello. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you? Have ye not understood? Four have you not. Hello. Then three participial double lines, verses 22 to 23. Three participial double lines. He that sitteth, verse 22, upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are like grasshoppers. He who spreadeth out the heavens like a curtain, spreadeth them out like a tent to dwell in. And he who bringeth the princes to nothing, maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. So he that sitteth, spreadeth, bringeth. You have these participles. Hayoshev, hanoteh, hanotain. Then three verbs introduced by scarcely or hardly. It's afbal in the Hebrew. Yea, the King James says, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. Three verbs introduced by scarcely or hardly at verse 24. Then a sharp wagam introduces the conclusion in 24b. That's the King James says, and he shall also, but that's wagam, and he shall blow on them and they shall wither. A whirlwind shall take them away like stubble. Now that conclusion provides the second climax, which makes the first one more definite. First one, nations are as nothing. But here, he's going to blow on them, they're going to wither and be taken away like stubble. Notice the comparison or correspondence between the triad of verse 22 and 23, that's those participial double lines, with the first three strophes. Verse 22, God is creator. See, verse 22 speaks about the one who sitteth on the circle of the earth, and the heavens are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain, spreads them out like a tent dweller. That's God as creator compares with that first trophy. Who created the universe? Whereas verse 23, God's work in history, compares with the third trophy. The nations are as nothing. See the those participles, he that sitteth and he that spreadeth, the first two strophes, nature. He that bringeth the princes to nothing, that's history. And that compares with God's work in history, you see, the third of those double participial lines. So you get a repetition of structure moving from nature to history, to each of nature, to one of history in both places. You move to the sixth trophy, 25 to 27. Why sayest thou, O Jacob? Or excuse me, I went down to 27. 25. To whom then will you liken me, or who shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who created these things? Who bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for he is strong in power, not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due to me is passed away from my God? 25 to 27, the Lord is incomparable. You have that same question, you see, introducing strophe 6 as you had strophe 4. To whom will you compare? The Lord is incomparable. And you see, the real focus of that section in 25 to 27 is in verse 27. Who will you compare the Lord to? You know, you look at his creative power. How can you say in verse 27 that my way is hidden from the Lord? You may be in difficulty, you may be in misery, you may not understand what's going on, but when you focus on who God is, on his rule over nature, his rule over history, how can you ever question that he doesn't know what is going on with you? Why do you say history is the ultimate comfort for God's people in distress? Again, that's introduced by question. Have you not known? Just like that second climax was. Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? That the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint. To those who have no might, he increaseth strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary. The young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So you see in verse 27, the preceding verse, how can one who is so powerful forget those whom he has set apart for his own purposes? Why do you say my way is hid from the Lord? And 28 to 31 are the answer to that question. The answer again is given in general terms, I think, that apply to all situations where people are tempted to doubt God. If God's plan doesn't seem to be working out, you can be sure it's not because he is too weak to do what he chooses. It's rather because we don't fully understand his plan. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting Lord, the God, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There's no searching of his understanding. We can't search his understanding. He knows the end from the beginning. We don't. And we may not understand exactly what the reasons are for the situation in which we find ourselves. But his power is sufficient to accomplish all that he undertakes to do. He never faints, he's never weary. But not only that, he gives power to those who tend to become weary if they will wait upon the Lord. And that's the message then to God's people, to wait upon the Lord. And they will renew their strength. So, chapter 40 is a remarkable chapter. I'll kind of rush through this. I hope this diagram gives you some idea of the complexity of the organization and the careful way in which it is constructed. Even though it, you know, if you read through it and try to outline it, it's very difficult to outline. But there's a very careful structure there, repetition of things, structural organization that hits you forcefully when you read the chapter, even though you don't have it analyzed. You don't know why. So, you know, it's one of the people's favorite chapters in the Bible, Isaiah chapter 40, with good reason. Okay, what I want to do from this point, you notice on your outline, is move to the servant of the Lord theme. I gave you those, what did I give you, five or six themes. I don't see my overhead for that. There were five? Okay. Be nice if we could move through Isaiah 41 on through 66 and trace the way all those themes are developed. And it's unfortunate to have to lift one out because you don't get the full impact because they're all closely related. They work together. But with time considerations, we just can't do that. So what I want to do is take the one theme, the servant of the Lord theme, and work through that theme. Which certainly is one of great importance, particularly from a messianic perspective, and see how that works. Now, a few comments just in general before we get into specific passages. Critical scholars have often attempted to isolate what they call the four servant songs. We read there in Wybrae the comment about the four so-called servant songs. That's top of page 29 of your citations. But the four that are normally isolated are 42, 1 to 7. It's really not correct to limit the servant passages to those four major passages. But those are certainly four major passages. But critical scholars often isolate those four and say they have their own separate origin and authorship. They're secondary to the original text. They've been inserted into the original text. But as I mentioned, that theme is much more complex than being limited to just those four passages. And it's found in numerous other places as well. What I want to do is trace through every reference to the servant in this section of Isaiah as we look at the servant theme. So let's begin that. And what we want to do is see how this servant theme relates to this larger problem of the exiles I already mentioned, what the connection is, and of course how it relates to the coming of Christ. First one is Isaiah 41:8 and following. You read there, "But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend, thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, thou art my servant. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. I will help thee. Yea, I will hold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." I'm not going to read further for the moment. We will later. But that's the first occurrence, you see, in verse 8 and 9 of the expression, "the servant of the Lord, thou art my servant." The Lord speaking. First appearance in the book of Isaiah. Now, elsewhere in the Old Testament, the term is used in a variety of ways, often simply of godly people, sometimes more specifically of prophets. It's used of Moses, it's used of Joshua, it's used of Elijah. But as used in Isaiah, it takes on a particular significance. And that becomes clear as we trace the theme. It begins here in 41. It grows in importance, reaches its climax in chapter 53. As we see, as we will see, at first it's not altogether clear exactly what's meant by the phrase, even though this verse 8 seems quite explicit. It gets more complicated as we move. It seems here, "Israel, you are my servant." Who is the servant? It seems here that Israel is the servant. And what we find in this passage is the Lord gives the reason why he's going to protect Israel. He says he has chosen Israel as one to be his servant. "Thou, Israel, art my servant." Verse 10, "Fear not, for I am with thee. I will strengthen thee. I will help thee. I will uphold thee." You go down to verse 13, "For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye men of Israel, I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I will make thee a new, sharp, threshing instrument, having teeth." If you read through the passage, the servant is called by God, will not be cast off, the enemies of the servant will be confounded. But the strength of the servant is to be found in the Lord, not in himself. See, verse 14 says, "I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I will make thee a sharp threshing instrument." So it seems clear in 41 that the servant is Israel. The extent of the passage is not altogether clear how far this theme goes, probably down to verse 19. But that's somewhat debated. But all is quite general there. Let's go to the second passage, and that's one of the major ones. 42:1-7. "Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I put my spirit upon him, he shall bring forth justice to the nations. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth justice and truth. He shall not fail, nor be discouraged, till he have set justice in the earth. And the coast shall wait for his law. Thus saith God, the Lord, He who created the heavens. Here you get an interspersal of a verse with that creative power theme. He who spread forth the earth and that which cometh out of it, He who bringeth breath to the people upon it, spirit to them to walk in it. I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thine hand, will give thee and give, will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. So in 42:1-7, again you're talking about the servant, behold my servant. And a picture is presented of the work the servant will do. And the servant is to do a work in the world for God. Here it doesn't say who the servant is, as 41:8-9, where it says, Thou Israel art my servant. Here it doesn't say who the servant is, but a picture is given of the work the servant is to accomplish. It's interesting if you turn to Matthew 12:18-21, that this passage is applied to Jesus. Matthew 12:18, Behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit on him. He shall show justice to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets of bruised reed he shall not break. Smoking flax shall he not quench. Shall he send forth justice into victory. And that's in the context applied clearly to Jesus. But here's what it says in verse 42, Behold my servant whom I uphold, mine elect. The servant is God's elect, in whose soul he delighteth, and the Spirit of God is on him, and he's going to bring justice to the nations or to the Gentiles. In verses 2-4, you have the dignity and gentleness of his conduct. Not going to cry or lift up or cause his voice to be heard in the street. Bruised reed he shall not break. He doesn't exert violent effort to accomplish his task. But his work is to be worldwide. Notice verse 4. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he have set justice in the earth. And the coasts shall wait for his wall. Distant lands. Verse 5 sort of interrupts this description of the work of the servant to answer the question, how can this be? How's this possible? Well, it's possible because God says so, and God is the creator of the heavens. Thus saith God, the Lord, He who created the heavens, stretched them out and spread them out. Now, questions begin to arise at this point. You see, in 41:8-9, it says, Israel, you are my servant. But the question that arises is, how can Israel fulfill what's described here? How can a people in bondage and misery, in exile, do what here it is said the servant of the Lord will do? See, verse 6 and 7 says, I will give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light to the Gentiles, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from prison, to those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. How can Israel do that when Israel herself is a prisoner? And that question is not just one that might come to your mind as you read it, or to the mind of the person who heard it. It's one that's expressed later in the chapter as well. Let's go down to verse 19. Who is blind but my servant? Or deaf as my messenger that I sent? Who is blind as he that is perfect, and blind as the Lord's servant? seeing many things, but thou observest not, opening the ears, but he heareth not. The Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will magnify the law and make it honorable. But this people is a people robbed and spoiled. They're all of them snared in holes. They're hidden in prison houses. Therefore pray, none delivereth, for spoil, none saith restore. So in verse 19, that very question is expressed. How can Israel do this when she herself is blind and deaf? But verse 21 says, the work of the servant will be done. The Lord is well pleased for his righteous sake. He will magnify the law and make it honorable. And in verse 22, again you have that difficulty. How can Israel fulfill the demands of the work of the servant when Israel is a people robbed and spoiled, snared in holes, hidden in prison houses? And the problem seems unanswerable. But there's an additional note in verse 24. 24 says, who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? Did not the Lord, against whom we have sinned? Verse 24 points out why Israel is in the condition they're in. Why is Israel robbed and spoiled? Why is Israel in the prison house? Why is Israel blind? It's because they sinned. And because they sinned, God gave his people into exile and suffering. Who gave Jacob first spoil and Israel to the robbers? Did not the Lord, against whom we have sinned? For they would not walk in his ways, neither were they obedient unto his law. Therefore he hath poured upon them the fury of his anger, the strength of battle. So you see in 42, you have the servant presented as one who is to bring light and deliverance to the ends of the earth, to the Gentiles, to the nations, to deliver from captivity and prison and bondage. And 41 has said Israel is God's servant. But the question is, how can Israel do that when Israel herself is in bondage and in darkness because of her sin? So we got to trace this theme further. You see, up to this point, we have a lot of questions. Israel is a servant. Israel has a task to do. But it doesn't seem Israel is able to do the task because Israel herself is sinful and is in bondage. And you need some kind of resolution of that as we go further. My time is over. We'll pick up the theme further.